Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have with us from South Florida, Dr. Brian McLaren. How are you today, Brian?
Fantastic. Great to be with you.
Has it been a tough weekend for you all in South Florida, recovering from the loss of LeBron James?
You know, I'm just really, really happy for Cleveland.
Are you even a basketball fan?
You know, my wife is actually a bigger fan than I am. But the LeBron saga goes far beyond sports, right?
It's a very interesting narrative. And
seeing him go
back home. Yeah, it's fascinating.
It's sort of the new King James that everybody's talking about.
Yeah. Very, very true. Very true. Now, this morning I saw you posted something on your blog referencing the new Planet of the Apes movie. I guess you saw that this weekend as well.
I did. Yes.
What'd you think?
Well, you know, I'm just intrigued. One of the really disturbing things to me is how many movies promote violence as the solution to our problems. What's the motto? The only thing that can defeat a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always interested to see if movies try to poke through that, what Walter Wing called the myth of redemptive violence. Mm-hmm. And this movie had a lot of violence,
yes,
but it seemed to me it was also trying to poke through that that myth. So I was impressed, very impressed in that way. Of course, the animation and the great CGI, it's just stunning.
Yeah, it's very, very, very interesting. And you had the quote about, the main hero ape who says, you know, I thought all apes were good, but, you know, bad apes, good apes, just like bad humans, good humans. It was a great line.
It really is a great line, especially when you think in today's world, you've got Sunni and Shia and Christians and Muslims and Palestinians and Israelis and all kinds of groups that manage to keep an awful lot of war and violence and hatred going through that kind of us-them stereotyping. I just think it's a time to celebrate when a movie tries to go to the core of that. Of course, you know, the Planet of the Apes franchise has a great history of that. I remember back in the 60s when the first ones came out. And, you know, it's been a remarkable career. I think that series and the Hunger Games series are doing a really good job of getting people to think about violence.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. I didn't catch the first edition of the Planet of the Apes when it came out in the 60s. and I haven't seen the Hunger Games. But I definitely think the Planet of the Apes was a beautiful story. And the whole line about the line of good and evil isn't between us and them, but it's right down the middle of us. It's very well illustrated in that movie.
Yeah, very much so.
Now, you were an English professor.
Yes.
What was your specialty in English?
Well, I mean, most of the teaching I did was in writing, I had a couple of areas of interest that were very diverse. I was interested in medieval drama. I did a lot of work in Puritan devotional poetry, but I did my thesis on a then living novelist named Walker Percy, Southern novelist, mm-hmm, who wrote in kind of both the Southern tradition, but I was interested in him in the philosophical novel tradition. So I'm a huge Walker Percy devotee.
Can you explain for those of us who are not familiar with the philosophical novel genre?
Sure. Well, in the 20th century, I mean, this goes way back to like Candide by Voltaire, which was a novel grappling. It was a novel in many ways trying to ridicule a philosophical proposition. But in the 20th century, you had a lot of philosophers writing novels. You had Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, and the idea was that certain philosophical ideas could be explored more powerfully through fiction. And of course, this goes back to Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard wrote a lot of his philosophy in the form of narrative. So that really interested me with Walker Percy. He was especially interesting because he was an adult convert to Christian faith, quite thoughtful about his faith, and he wrote both nonfiction and fiction. So I was intrigued to see the way the ideas that he expressed directly in nonfiction were then explored indirectly in fiction.
Was that part of your impetus to become a writer who also does fiction and nonfiction?
You know, I'm sure it was. I mean, it's really just a couple months ago, I went back and reread Walker Percy's collection of essays called The Message in the Bottle. And rereading that, I realized, boy, so much of what I've written is in many ways a footnote to that book. I remember being in graduate school reading that and just being blown away by it. And so, yeah, that's had a big effect on me. And I still wonder when I'll decide to take a hiatus from nonfiction and focus on fiction again.
Really? Do you have a preference one over the other?
Well, I'll tell you, when I wrote A New Kind of Christian, in my first version of it was nonfiction. And
really?
Yeah. And I think I'd written maybe 150 pages, and I was maybe a quarter of the way through what I felt I needed to say. And I thought, nobody's going to read a 400-page book, including me. So that's when I decided to go back and recast it as fiction. And when that happened, so much you could leave. You didn't have to cross all your T's and dot all your I's, because people then imaginatively fill in the blanks and you fill in context. So much of nonfiction involves having to imagine every possible context of a reader and address all of their objections from many different angles, you know. So there's a real economy and efficiency to it. If you do it well, it draws readers in positive ways. So, you know, I hope I'll do it again. I have a few ideas.
Well, I hope you do too. But let's go back to the crossing the T's and dotting the I's. How does that shape how you communicate theology? How does that differ from if, like you said, you were going to do a 400-page treatise on theology in a traditional nonfiction format?
Well, you know, I think we all know the difference between scholarly writing and more popular writing. And in scholarly writing, there are a series of unwritten rules. It would actually be fun someday for somebody to take the unwritten rules of academic writing and make them overt. But for example, in any field, there's a canon of required reading. So if you publish something and you haven't mentioned or footnoted, you know, the 30 most important texts on that, then automatically in the academic world, you're discounted. And it's a little elusive to non-academics. They don't know, how do you get the list of these books, you know? And even you do your best to be exhaustive and somebody comes along and says, well, you didn't read this and this and this. So, you know, there's that whole kind of review of literature type thing that's very important. And then when you're theologically savvy, you know, there's this school of theology, that school, this approach, that approach. And you know, it's complicated enough if it's just liberals and conservatives, but there are 1,000 nuances to all of that. And then you have to realize, if I say this, they'll interpret it that way. They'll have these objections. That other group will have these objections. They'll want this corroborating evidence. They'll need this example from tradition. So in your mind, you have this very complicated, you know, imaginary audience out there that you're trying to make sure that you do a good job helping them with. But in fiction, you have two people talking. You just have to make sure this guy says something that would make sense to this guy.
Yeah. When you wrote A New Kind of Christian, did you realize that you had something really substantial? Did you understand the significance that story would hold for many people?
Well, you know, it was my first foray into anything like fiction. So
the first, like, you hadn't written anything else that didn't get published? That was the very first one?
Yeah, very first. And
wow.
And my later drafts were a lot better than my earlier drafts. I had a good editor who was tough on me and, you know, said, hey, what about this? What about this? So, you know, I knew I had content that felt very, very important. The question, but I also knew that a lot of people would be very upset with that content and wouldn't like it. So, by the way, one of the great examples of using fiction to convey serious ideas, Galileo's great work on the revolution of the planets, he wrote that as a fictional dialogue. And you realize he had to do that because he didn't want to go to jail. and by putting it as a dialogue, you could say, well, this is just the characters talking, you know.
But that didn't seem to work with you for some of the evangelical Christians in America. You couldn't just say, hey, I wrote this as fiction. Why are you guys so mad at me? Did you understand that, as you said, that there would be some people who are going to be upset with it? And did you understand the ramifications it would have for your relationship with the evangelical world?
Yeah, I did. In fact, if anything, a lot of my friends will tell you, I would say, I just can't believe that the response has not been more harsh. I was never surprised by the harshness of the response. I was surprised that it was slower in coming than I expected, and that I was, to some degree, surprised by the shoddiness and weakness of the counterarguments.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, beyond name calling, you're a liberal, you're this, you're that, or impugning motives, you know, you're doing this for this, these or those bad motives. In terms of actually engaging with the content, you know, I'm quite surprised that there has been very little substantive engagement. And I think, I hope that reflects the strength of the content that I'm proposing, but it also might say something about the weakness of even the gatekeepers of evangelicalism. Their only job in some ways is to say who's in and who's out, who's same, who's different. And then the assumption is as soon as somebody's different, we can just write them off. It's very different than in a community where you say, we have to have a vigorous debate about ideas and let's have this ongoing debate. That doesn't seem to be very sustained, sadly, in the evangelical world.
Why do you think there's such an emphasis on being gatekeepers instead of conversation starters or creators?
Well, you know, I wrote a book a couple years ago called Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? And when I wrote that book, it ended up being a book about religious identity, and it got me reading a lot of social theory about identity formation and group identity. And there are a lot of different ways that groups form their identity. And at any given moment, a group's identity has many layers and is probably fighting battles within and battles without. But one of the easiest ways to gain and maintain power in a group that's under stress, even a group that's not under stress, if they're not under stress, you create an imaginary enemy. And you promise protection from the imaginary. You tell people the enemy's real, and then you be the guard against them. You know, it's a great way to maintain power. And I do think many, you know, this goes back to the old fundamentalist modernist controversy that was way before my time. But the old Scopes monkey trial in the early 20th century. You know, fundamentalists came out of that not feeling, wow, we were discredited, our ideas don't stand up to public scrutiny. They came out of it feeling like we're persecuted, we're hated, we're misunderstood. And, you know, that becomes part of your identity. And you need the next enemy to reinforce we're the persecuted faithful few.
How do you think people can get beyond that sort of gatekeeper, persecuted minority few kind of mentality? What are ways that...
Yeah, it's funny, Luke, since I started working on that book, every time I read the Gospels, I just notice things I didn't notice before. So, for example, you think of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus starts, these people are blessed. It's the opposite people that you'd expect. But what he's doing is he's saying, I'm creating a different set of values for a group. Our group isn't valued on who are the rich and powerful. Our group isn't creating an in-group of who are the military victors, but rather we're saying the poor and the poor in spirit are blessed in this identity and in this community. You know, when Jesus says, blessed are they who mourn, I don't think many people have ever thought about this, but my guess is the word mourn means you mourn someone who's died. And I think what he's saying in the context of occupation and violence is, blessed are the people who've lost loved ones more than the people who have killed their enemy, you see? Mm-hmm. Because the people who've lost loved ones now see the charade of this whole violent regime. So he's creating this very different identity. And then he says, you are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. You are a city on a hill that can't be hid. He's creating a positive identity. It's not we're out to destroy them. It's we're out to shed light for them. They're not the enemy that we're afraid of. We're bringing salt and seasoning and savor to the world. We're not the enemy city on a hill who's afraid that people are going to attack us, so we're going to fight them off with tooth and nail. we're the seat on the hill that wants to be an example to other people, a very different identity. Yeah. And that's where I think healthy groups, whether it's a political party, a nation, a denomination, a religious community, one of the really important roles of leadership is to attend to the what constitutes identity in that group.
Well, there obviously is the other group that has been, quote unquote, kicked out by the gatekeepers. And in some ways, this has been a tribe that you have become a guru for. And you've been a person that receives the emails when people are trying to figure out what to do next. And I think that's part of the impetus behind your new book, along with many of your works, is you're trying to construct something to look forward to. And you even dedicate this new book, which is entitled We Make the Road by Walking, towards a young man who sends you an email about people who are feeling like they don't know what to believe and they don't know what's left for them.
Yeah.
Okay, so first of all, why is there such a growing number of this tribe that feel that way?
Well, a couple of years ago, a young evangelical guy named Dave Kinneman, who runs something called the Barna Research Group, he wrote a book called You Lost Me, and it was about how younger generations of evangelicals are feeling disaffiliated and disaffected with their heritage. And I just think we've reached a tipping point. You know, when I was a young evangelical in the early 1970s, I wasn't a big fan of, you know, big hair, of course, who am I to talk, but, you know, big hair televangelists. And I wasn't a big fan of what seemed to be kind of sentimental, syrupy Southern gospel music. And I wasn't a big fan of the sort of anti-communist hysteria of a lot of, you know, people don't realize that in his early days, Billy Graham wasn't known as an evangelist. He was sort of an anti-communist, you know, activist in some ways. But there were people like C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer and John Stott who represented this more magnanimous kind of evangelicalism. But what's happened for evangelicals, and I think something very similar has happened for Roman Catholics in the last 35 or 40 years, is that that magnanimous, generous kind of Christian faith has been more and more marginalized, and the identity has been constricted to something a little more angry and rigid, anti-intellectual, anti-science, and so on. And so, for example, a college like Bryan College, I mentioned the Scope Monkey Trials, you know, they're in the process of, in some ways, going back to whatever it was, 1927 or whatever, you know, more fervently anti-science fundamentalist than ever. And so young evangelicals, I just feel so sad for them. You know, it's they're just being driven out. And especially because one of the strongest indicators for whether someone changes their view on LGBT issues is whether they actually know any LGBT people, you know. Well, for younger people, their friends have been coming out since they were teenagers. So, you know, suddenly they're faced with a choice between staying in a church that vilifies their friends or being loyal to their friends, which very often means having to leave their church.
Now, in your book, you are specific that you want to make sure everyone realize that this work that you're putting out isn't to be done as a replacement for traditional church, but it's a resource. It's a useful tool that can be a catechesis for people in church. And so clearly you're not giving up on church, even though it might be a marginalized place for the more magnanimous Christians. Where do you see it going if you're not going to give up on church? Where do you see these disenfranchised evangelicals going?
Yeah, so I think a lot of disenfranchised evangelicals and Roman Catholics are going to end up in mainline Protestant churches. Now, mainline Protestants have their own set of issues and challenges and problems, but the thing I get to see, because I travel a lot, is there are really wonderful things happening in congregations around the country. You know, I'm part of a little Episcopal church in this little town in Southwest Florida, and this week, the whole church has been turned into a summer camp for kids with disabilities, and people from the church are all coming to serve meals and take kids on boat rides and all the rest. You know, this week our church is mobilized to do something really, really beautiful for kids with disabilities and for their families whose kids don't get to have as much fun as they're going to have this week. Every night there's wild dancing and games and fun. You know, it's just fantastic. And around the country, there are congregations doing wonderful things. And so I think a lot of people will end up there. I also think that there are evangelicals who are losing their fear of the gatekeepers, mm-hmm. and they're changing. Whole congregations are changing. And I think that's not an easy process for the first 20 to do it, and it's a little less hard for the next 100. But after several hundred sort of cross a Rubicon, it will be a lot easier, and I think there'll be change. In the Catholic community, it's more complicated because of the way the diocesan system works in Catholicism. So there are just a whole lot of Catholics who either stop going to Mass or they show up from time to time, but they carry on their spiritual life in other ways. And actually, that's one of the uses I hope We Make the Road by Walking can be put to for some of these folks who need to create some kind of faith community that they feel they can actively participate in.
Yeah. Well, as you're talking about changing, it reminds me of a quote. I think it was on Rachel Held Evans' blog. And you say this: in order to get God back at a higher level, we have to be willing to let the lower level conceptions of God go. So if we're going to change, there are certain conceptions, lower level conceptions of God, that have to be eradicated. Can you give some examples of what those would be and why we need to get rid of those?
Yeah. So let me not to quibble here, but I wouldn't use the word eradicated because for a couple of reasons.
You're the English guy, so give me the better word. What's the better word?
Well, the reason I say that is because, you know, if people feel that people are out to stamp out their view of God, that makes them feel threatened and under attack, and then they become defensive. And I don't think that, I think that's counterproductive.
Okay.
I think what has to happen is that we have to articulate better visions of God that people migrate to. And it generally doesn't happen in one generation. You know, it takes a couple of generations. So the big challenge to me is a creative and an artistic challenge. The creative challenge that involves good scholarship and academic work, really entering into the scriptures, really entering into the Christian tradition, really understanding it at its heart. And then expressing that both in normal discourse in form of sermons and books and so on, and things like creeds and prayers, but also in the form of songs. I just think songs are extremely important. In fact, I was just part of a phone call right before this one with a group of progressive Christian songwriters who are trying to work together to get a better quality of song out there for people. But I'll just give a quick example if that'd be helpful, Luke. If you take the image of God as a king, now I don't know historically when the first king appears, but let's say the first king appears something like 10 or 15,000 BC. I mean, before that you have warlords, what we might call warlords or tribal chieftains, but eventually a group of chieftains get together and they are either conquered or they make an agreement to let somebody be the chief of the chiefs. And at some point you get something that we would call a king, right? Before that happens, nobody ever referred to God as king. That was just, it was a metaphor that didn't, it was a reality that didn't exist to be a metaphor for God. Now, if you look at the ancient king as someone who reduces violence among warring tribal factions and warring tribes, then you might say a king was the most advanced peacemaking technology of the day. So they use an image for the most advanced and effective way to make peace to describe God. Now, today, kings are not the most effective way to make peace, you know?
Yeah.
So every time we refer to God as king today, we're saying something very, very different from what they were saying in the 8th century BC when they referred to God as king.
Yeah.
So then the question comes, to be a person who's faithful to scripture and faithful to the tradition, how do we find the words to talk about God today that will do for us what that image did, 2,700 years ago or something?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And that seems to be kind of the language you use when you're describing the Bible as a static revelation instead of this, set in stone understanding of who God is, that it's concretized to that understanding. And to kind of circle back even more, when you're talking about giving a better understanding, is that why you use the language of this work being a constructive theology? Is that what you're going for?
Yeah, I mean, this is a relatively new term, constructive theology. I first really encountered it through Claremont Theological Seminary, where I'm honored to serve on the board. And the theologians who are using this term, they're doing a couple of things. One thing is they're trying to say we're post-critical. Now, post-critical does not mean pre-critical, and it doesn't mean critical. It means that the last 100, 200 years of critical thought and theology is all, we're taking all of that seriously. But once you've done critique, where do you go instead? See? So once you've critiqued the metaphor of king, referring to God, where do you go after that? Mm-hmm. And also the word constructive is a way of saying, and we're aware that everything we say is a construction. We're creatively assembling it. And we're doing that. We're trying to do it in faithfulness to the tradition. We're trying to do it in faithfulness to the needs of the moment. And ultimately, we're trying to do it in faithfulness to God. So that's why I really like this term, constructive theology. I think it's a self-aware term.
Yeah, it seems like that in some ways is the antithesis to the type of faith that is impervious to new evidence.
Yes.
But that seems to be a rut that we get stuck into where we go, well, Hebrews says God is the same yesterday, today, and forever, so therefore this is what it is. How do we not get stuck in this impervious to new evidence kind of mentality about faith?
Yes, well, I think there are no foolproof solutions for humans determined to be foolish. But I think you're asking a really great question. And I think this is almost like it's a Rubicon, or it's a threshold that we have to cross. Because up till now, what's happened in Christian history, and by the way, I think this has happened in science and in philosophical traditions as well, we've always had the sense that, oh, as soon as we identify the errors in today's set of theories, we'll have things right forever. Mm-hmm. But I think we're just coming of age as a civilization, as a species, to where we say, you know what? All of our knowledge is provisional, and there will be a winnowing process as we go through. What I hope is that Christian faith can reach this place of self-awareness that we can say, yeah, you know, we aren't the community that has it right. We're the community that continually learns and grows and seeks improvement. And my gosh, that has to happen in the Christian faith. It has to happen in Islam. It has to happen in Judaism. You know, in every community, I think a similar kind of shift in paradigm has to happen.
But there's part of me that wants to say, well, if this is true, then it's right. And so it doesn't need to change and evolve. And it almost sounds to me like part of what you're saying is, well, it can't be true if it needs to be continually revisited and updated.
Well, yeah, and this is where we have to become a little more savvy about what we mean when we say the word true. So let me give you two examples from science. If I say to you, Luke, is an atom composed of a nucleus with protons and neutrons surrounded by an electron or a group of electrons orbiting around the nucleus, we'd say, okay, that's true. What we mean by that is it conforms to our best understanding right now. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to guess that real particle physicists would listen to that and say, well, that's a really immature and 20th century way of looking at this. You know, we know that atoms are way more complicated than that, and there's a whole lot more going on. And now we doubt whether there is this little billiard ball called a proton and a little billiard ball called a neutron. And we doubt that the electron is actually like a little marble spinning around the billiard balls. So that whole set of images that we use with the word atom, people who really know, mm-hmm. know, yes, it's true, but it's also subject to improvement and it's also limiting. It's useful and limiting. And when you can live with that, you don't throw it out and say it's false. You just say it's not the only way to see it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. And there's a little
By the way, you can do the same thing with gravity. We can say, why does something fall when you drop it? Well, because of gravity. Okay. Now we understand it. But And we've spoken the truth. But the irony is nobody knows what gravity is. It's just a word to describe this mystery. Hmm. And so often our statement of the truth makes us think that mystery has been removed when the fact is mystery has only been named.
Oh, that's a great line. Mystery has only been named. Yeah, that's really good. Well, one of the things that you argue in this book is that the essence of what we're all after is to be alive. And that's what we're all, that's what makes us do everything. That's what makes us get up in the morning. That's what makes foodies be foodies and religious people religious. I mean, that's, we all want to be alive. So can you kind of give more of an explanation of what it means to be alive?
You know, I've been thinking about this for a long time. I was a pastor for 24 years and I had to ask myself, why do people get up on a Sunday and come to church, especially in today's world where nobody's forcing them to, where nobody thinks you're a bad person if you don't. It's almost, you know, odd. At least it's a little different now that I live in the South. But when I lived up in Maryland, you know, church attendance rates were pretty low.
Yeah.
So why do people do this? And, you know, there's a whole range of reasons. But there was this, when I was honest about myself and when I really tried to hear what I heard in other people. I mean, sometimes it's that there's a problem, and this problem is reducing our sense of aliveness. It's guilt, it's conflict in my marriage, it's questions, it's insecurity, fear. So now I need some place to deal with this problem so that my aliveness can, you know, flourish again. Other times things are going great and life is so good that it makes us hungry and thirsty for even more. So that's, to me, you know, the more I look around, I think, why does a comedian like to make people laugh? Why do people like to go hear a stand-up comic? You know, why did I want to go see Planet of the Apes the other night? And I think so much of our life, basic survival is just staying alive.
Mm-hmm.
But almost everything we do beyond that then is this pursuit of greater aliveness. I think it's what Jesus referred to when he spoke of life to the full, abundant life. And that very misunderstood word, eternal life, which I just think we've really botched up, because I think in Jesus' lips, that term means life of the ages or life to the full.
Mm-hmm. So in what way is the quest for aliveness the best thing about religion? How does religion and aliveness go together?
Well, let me maybe give three quick examples. If,
see, you are a pastor. You're going to give me three examples. That's good.
And I'll start with the letter P.
Nice.
So yesterday when I was in church, you know, because I was a pastor for all those years, I really enjoyed going to church now that I'm not a pastor, because I get to sort of observe myself as a Christian and not, you know, the guy up front.
Yeah.
And so yesterday we had a confession of sin in our service. And I thought to myself, I need this. I need to say these words because, you know, some stuff starts creeping in my heart, creeping in my soul. And if I don't stay vigilant, that stuff could really mess me up, you know? And my wife is next to me and I'm thinking, yeah, and she's got some stuff. If she doesn't confess her sins, it could mess her
up. Did you tell
her
that?
Yeah.
Honey, you need to really say a few things here. Yeah.
Yeah. You might want to repeat that confession of sin. Yeah, we don't nudge each other, but you know, the fact is I know she's thinking similar thoughts as she's there, because we're both sincere in our attendance. So I'm aware that, that there are rituals that we go through that actually help me, to face the things that could steal, kill, and destroy aliveness in me. But then another thing we did in church yesterday is we have communion every week, and you know, people go up in an aisle or go up in a line to receive the bread and wine. And so while I was in the back row yesterday, so as I'm seeing watching all these people go up, and I'm just thinking, there's my brother, there's my sister, there's my brother, there's my sister. I mentioned we have a lot going on with people with disabilities. I see a young woman with Down syndrome, and I just look at her, I say, there's my sister, you know. There's something about that that makes me more alive. And I think that's where church has this enormous capacity. If we could just get beyond what I call the checklist mentality, if we could just get beyond that, you know, you got to have a prelude, you got to have a sermon, mm-hmm. and get to the real purpose of it. I think there's good reasons to be there.
If you were talking to yourself, you know, 20 years ago when you're, you know, just starting outside in Maryland, being a pastor, what would you say to yourself to encourage you as a pastor to help people experience the aliveness and not get caught up in the minutia of like you're just describing, the checklist mentality.
Well, I'll tell you what I wish I could go back and tell myself is, first, to realize that there are all kinds of religious consumers out there who are looking for a product. You know, it's like going to the ice cream store and they're looking for, you know, butter, Baby Ruth, pecan, marshmallow, you know, mix.
Yeah.
And they have a very, you know, they're looking for something. And if you understand your role as just fulfilling the customer's demands, it's not going to go well, because they all have competing demands, you know. I think if I could go back and say to myself, try to identify what these key issues of aliveness are and really focus on that essence, you know, that's what I wish I could have done, because I think for a long time I took people's sort of market tastes way too seriously, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the key issues of aliveness?
Well, I think one is, this might sound ironic to say first, but I think it's being connected to ourselves. And the reason I say that is because I don't think if we're not honest with ourselves, it's highly unlikely that we're going to be very honest with God or anybody else. So that sort of coming to yourself and mm-hmm. finding ways to help you reflect on what's actually going on in your life, that's a big deal. And then connecting with God. And you know what I said about gravity before, just using the word names the mystery. Mm-hmm. And every week for me to be reminded that the mystery of who and what God is greater and more glorious than I've ever understood. You know, I that's something I feel a need for. So often it feels like what happens in religion is we're trying to get God in a box, when what really should be happening is we should be, you know, having that box blown open to say God is bigger and more wonderful mystery than we imagine. Yeah. And then to be connected with others, the people in our families, and because that's where so much of our life is lived, and then others in our congregation. And then to be connected with people suffering around the world. I mean, I don't want to go to church as a fairyland escape from reality. In church, I want to be reminded that suffering is going on in Gaza right now and in Israel, and that we've got to pray for peace. And, you know, I want to be connected with the world in a greater way.
Yeah, I think in church we imagine we're going there to be connected to God. And we get the idea we're connected to others. That's part of the social aspect. That's why you're not at home watching on your computer when you go to church. Okay, we get that. But the idea of being connected to ourselves probably is novel to some of us.
Yeah.
Give us an idea or a way that we can be connected more to ourselves through religion or spirituality.
Okay. Well, let me give two examples.
Okay.
Something often happens in the beginning of a church service. Sometimes there's a prelude, or there's some music, or there's something that sort of is intended to get people in the mood, you know, there. I think this, we have to pay a lot more attention to this. I learned a lot about this when I go to a yoga class. If I go to a yoga class, almost always there's a beginning of breathing, and there's almost always saying something about, you know, catch up with yourself, realize where you are, take a few deep breaths, feel your body. It's as if in yoga, they've come to realize that before you go anywhere, you've got to catch up with yourself and be present.
Yeah.
I think that we need something like that in Christian worship, to be here, to be aware, to wake up, to come off autopilot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's important. Second example would be, I mentioned the confession of sin before. I mean, if someone were to say to me, let's go back over, or if we were to say to a congregation, let's go back over the week ahead. Think of a moment when someone hurt you. Think of a moment when someone insulted you, took you for granted, hurt your feelings. Let's hold that moment and realize that either we can have resentment, we can think little of ourselves because of that, or we can now process that pain in a constructive way in God's presence. Wow, you know, that would be just about everybody gets hurt or insulted.
Yes.
In the course of a week, you know? And then we have to say, well, now think, you probably hurt and insulted some other people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's pause and think about that. Let's have empathy for the people. You might not have intended it, but let's think about how your words or actions or inactions hurt someone else. You know, that kind of a thing, it seems to me, brings us more in touch with ourselves as we really are.
Is that why you put an emphasis on First of all, let me backtrack and explain the book if people haven't got a copy of it yet. It's a year-long quest for spiritual formation, reorientation, activation. And so there's basically a reading that they're supposed to do as a group each week, and then there's reflections afterwards. And in those reflections, it seems like meditation is always part of that reflection. Is that why you included that as kind of the prescripted spiritual practice?
Yeah. So there are seven questions at the end of each chapter, and there are, I think there are six questions at the end of each chapter. six questions at the end of each chapter.
And, you can add a seventh if you want, though.
That's right. Too late. But the sixth question is always a meditate question. And the idea is, you know, before we leave, before we carry on with our lives, let's slow down and let's just let some things sink in. I love it how the old mystic said it, descend from your mind into your heart. And there's that slowing process of savoring things, you know, and we have a fast food culture, but we also have a slow food culture that says, hey, let's slow down and let's appreciate, you know, and I think we need the same thing spiritually.
Yeah. Except when you have little kids, then you don't want to have slow food. Just eat as fast as you
can.
Get
it done as soon as you can. That's right.
Well, when I was reading through this book, my thought as a pastor is this could be really great for a small group curriculum. Yeah. And you describe the audience as learning circles. And again, you're very explicit to say this is not in replacement of church, but it is what you call a catechesis, or what actually many Christians throughout the years have called that. Can you kind of explain what that is for people who've never heard the word catechesis?
Yeah. Well, and first, let me say I'm really, really thrilled. There's a guy who's blogging. I have a link on my website, but he's blogging over at patheos.com, and he's using this as a family gathering, kind of a family catechesis each week. And he's pulling together videos to go along with it and all kinds of resources from the web. And it's really fun what he's doing. So I'm really happy people are using it with their families or using it in small groups. And I've heard from several congregations. One Methodist pastor just contacted me and said that next year the book will be their structure for the whole year of sermons, and then they're going to get their Sunday school classes to develop curriculum for kids based on this, so that adults and kids will all be going through the same thing for the next year. Wow. And that's tremendously gratifying and exciting for me, and I know it will be helpful because we field tested it already and have had great, great results.
Oh, you field tested? Can I explain what that was?
Sure. So while I was writing the book, I had three different groups. Two of them were new groups that were just starting, and another group already existed. And they took the material as I was writing it and started working with it. And they gave me feedback on what worked well and what didn't. And then right around the time the book came out, we got a bunch of people together for 4 days. And for 4 days, we just experimented with using it in all different kinds of ways. And I hope this doesn't sound proud in a bad way, but it really exceeded my expectations. So really that went well. But
that's
getting
great.
Back to your question, the idea of catechesis means an orderly introduction or orientation to the faith. And the idea is that it's orderly, that it's comprehensive, and that it's coherent. It's not just scattershot, mm-hmm. and it gives you some big overview. So what I wanted to try to do in these 52 chapters is to give an overview of the Christian faith and of the Bible. So basically, I start with the school year, September. It's actually the last Sunday in August, is start with Genesis 1. You cover the Old Testament up through Advent. Then with Christmas, you begin the life of Christ, and that carries you through Easter. And then from Easter through the rest of the summer, you're introduced to the church and the rest of the New Testament.
So people have plenty of time to get on this. They can buy their copy and then be ready to go by September.
They've exactly.
got a month and a half to get on there.
That's right.
Well, that's good. I really found it to be fascinating. I thought it was a great, great concept. And like, as you said, you had Methodist contact you. You've probably had people from different denominations and fellowships that have all said that. And so even in the book, you mentioned that, you know, you've literally have, you know, thousands of churches, many denominations, from Southern Baptist to Greek Orthodox, from easy for me to say, from Pentecostal to Presbyterian, from Quaker to Roman Catholic to Adventist to Unitarian. You've had interactions with all of those. And so your material will be great for regardless of what flavor you come from. But since you've been involved and had connections with all those different flavors and traditions of Christianity, I think you'd be a great person to answer the question of, which one's right?
There you go. Well, the answer to that one's easy. They're all working on it.
Yeah. Well, you make the argument, and also since you make the argument that you're trying to bring these diverse movements together and to share the common inspiration that they have. And so this might be a great resource for some people of different flavors and traditions to break bread together.
Yes. You know, it's really interesting. People would be surprised how many Unitarian pastors and members I hear from who say, you know, I've been Unitarian because it's very open-minded and so on, but it's like the one taboo subject is Jesus. We never talk about Jesus, but I think Jesus is pretty great, you know?
Yeah.
And so what's happening, I think, is a whole lot of Unitarians find out that if they're welcome to the table, they want to talk about Jesus too. And they bring great resources to the table, and they will gain a lot by being at that table as well. And then you think Roman Catholics, you know, with all the terrible scandals that have happened in the Catholic Church, you know, Catholics are in many ways trying to get their footing again. Some are very defensive. We're still the only people who are right. That's just a minor problem. Other people are somewhat disillusioned, you know, and the new Pope has given people some fresh hope. Oh, maybe Catholicism can become something different than what it's been the last 30 or 40 years. And in mainline Protestantism, you know, there's a sense that people are losing ground and numbers are declining and the congregations are aging, and evangelicalism has its own set of issues, political and so on. But, you know, at the essence of our faith, it just feels like this is a time we want to go back to the heart of our faith. And that's kind of the bell that I would like to ring.
Well, I think your book is brilliant. I think it's a great resource that I encourage everyone to get a copy of. So, Brian, thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Great questions. Great being with you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.